to me, the dead are just as much a part of a parish as the living.
Part of what I've been doing is working on the early writings of James Connolly. And it's finished in terms of the writings, and what I'm doing now is just footnoting. Right. So I'm about halfway through footnoting. So I reckon that by end of Feb that'll be footnoted, and then it's just like it's ready for proofreading and for laying out. So we're still aiming for being published in August, September of this year, you know.
So for us non-academics, what does footnoting mean?
Footnoting is just, it's a footnote is basically what I'm doing now to your question, which is that when you read something, like in a text, and you go, what does that mean, or where's that from, there's a little kind of footnote at the end, like these things here, which tells you where it's from.
Right.
So that what you can do then is that its purpose from a historical kind of point of view is that then other people can check my work.
Right.
And they can see whether I'm bullshitting or not.
Right.
Which brings us very neatly into see Desmond Greaves, because Greaves very rarely footnoted in his life and times of James Connolly. He would footnote some stuff, but the stuff that was important, he didn't really. And the reason why I kind of brought him up is that I'm dealing with his early life, of course, and a lot of what is taken as gospel about James Connolly's early years, which I put as before he moved back to Ireland in 1896 for the ISRP, when he's in his, from his time of his birth until 1896, the main source up until very recently has been C. Desmond Greaves' book. So what I've been doing is that I'm trying to footnote his writings. So when I go looking for what Greaves says about Connolly during that time, it doesn't match.
Right.
It doesn't match what I'm finding. And the James Connolly I've been reading about is not the James Connolly that's in C. Desmond Greaves' book.
Is it that radically different, yeah?
I think it is. And it's why, like, I think that this might work best as a series of kind of podcasts, because there are so many problems with the early years of kind of James Connolly's life, as told by Greaves, that it deserves more than just one, because it'll get lost in the detail, because the issue is very subtle. It's always kind of subtle kind of differences. So one is that, you know, he says that, like, the James Connolly that Greaves kind of talks about, he's influenced by other people all the time, you know. He's not quite Dougal, but it's kind of like people tell him things about Marxism. He goes, oh, that's interesting. Or they tell him about, you know, how to apply Marxism to Ireland. And he goes, oh, that's really interesting. And that's not the Connolly I'm finding about. He's a very original thinker, well-versed in, like, Marxism. His very first printed words, it's a Marxist reading of Money and Wealth, which he wrote as a letter to the Edinburgh Evening News in 1891, in February, June or July or so of, like, 1891.
And was he living in Edinburgh at that time?
He was. He was living in Edinburgh from at least 1890 until 1890, end of 1895 at least. That's another thing. Greaves gets some of his addresses wrong, because he was a member of two organizations. One was the Independent Labour Party, which he helped form in Edinburgh in 1893. He was the first kind of secretary, so he wrote all the minutes and was over there kind of last month. It was gas, just seeing his handwriting, because it's so distinctive. You go, that's him, you know. And he was in the Scottish Socialist Federation. In both organisations, he was in with his brother.
Yeah.
So with the Independent Labour Party, his brother was vice president of the local branch, and he was secretary. So John Connolly was vice president, and Jimmy was secretary in the socialist, in the Scottish Socialist like Federation. They switched roles. John Connolly, he was secretary for a while, and then Jimmy was. We don't have any minutes from the SSF, from the Scottish Socialist Confederation. So it's all kind of secondhand or from news reports. But that comes in later, because what I think has happened is that I might just focus in on one element of the Greaves story. Greaves is the man who is who was pretty much kind of responsible for the story that Connolly was in the British Army. It's all from him.
Yeah.
No one else talked about it apart from a right-wing anti-trade union newspaper in 1913 called the Toiler, T-O-I-L-E-R, which I can't pronounce with my dub accent, Toiler. But and they said that he was in the Monaghan kind of militia. But he also said that Jim Larkin, he was related to Carey, the informer in the Invincibles. It was just a slander piece from Carey. So there's no, like, it's Greaves who says he was in the army. Greaves doesn't footnote.
Was it Greaves that said that he was 14 when he's...
Yes.
Yeah, he was underage.
So everything we know about Connolly comes from Greaves, because since he said in 1961 that James Connolly was in the British Army, and he very well may have been, I'm not taking a side here,
yeah.
But no evidence has been produced in the last 60, in the 63 years since Greaves first said that, not one shred of evidence has ever been produced.
And of course, the British Army was meticulous in their documentation.
And we do have records of his brother, because his brother served in the British Army, and his records are available on the various ancestry sites that are out there, because it's all been kind of digitized. So his brother's records are there. So it all comes from Greaves. So it's worth looking into. Well, where does Greaves get his sources from? And he's very cagey in it. It seems to be, what's happened in the last kind of 4 or 5 years is that Greaves' diaries are now being transcribed and being put up online. So what happens is that in his diary, we can see who he's talking to and where he gets these sources from. And it seems that there are two main sources for the James Connolly Army story that he bases it on.
Right.
One is people who we talked to in the 1950s in Edinburgh who say that they knew Connolly back, 50 years ago. And then there's another guy who is called John Mulvey, who Greaves calls John Mullery.
Got his name wrong as well.
Well, it's interesting because he was actually called both, and we'll go into that later on. But it's all based on what Greaves calls John Mullery, right? Mm-hmm. And so everything comes from these two sources. Now, in the National Library, there's a letter that Greaves wrote to William O'Brien. And William O'Brien was a former member of the ISRP and then was head of the ITGAW. Had more influence on the trade union movement than pretty much any other one single figure. He didn't completely formulate it, but he had the most influence by far.
Right.
Because of the ITGAW, he split the Irish Congress in 1942 because of Larkin, and because Larkin, but because Labour was actually gaining strength. So he splits the Labour movement and the Labour Party at a time when they were looking like they could actually overtake Fianna Fáil. So a very kind of reactionary kind of person. But Greaves wrote to him in 1956, and the letter is in the National Library.
Mm-hmm.
And what Greaves says in it is that I've been working on this kind of biog of James Connolly. At this stage, Greaves is infamous or famous because he found that Connolly was born in Edinburgh and he found his birth cert.
Right.
So that pretty much gave Greaves his kudos, because right. he had proven this.
And Connolly was saying he was born in Monaghan in the census, is that right?
He was saying that in the census, in speeches, he would say that he was from the Black North.
Right.
So he was always kind of cagey about it. His wife told William O'Brien he was born in Monaghan, and he moved in like 1880 to Edinburgh. Found the 1891 census in Edinburgh, when it's just the two of them. It's prior to Mona, their first child being born. And in it, here, I actually have it here, and in it, where am I? Yeah, here it is here. You can see here that it's asked, where you born? And Jimmy says, Edinburgh. And the wife says, Ireland. So the wife knew he was born in Edinburgh. But the story had become that he was from kind of Monaghan.
He's 22 at this.
Yeah, because it's in April or so, 1891.
What's the saying there?
Dust Carter.
All right. That's in occupation.
Yeah.
Professional occupation, Dust Carter.
Yeah. Really? So she was well aware of it. She knew the family. So the story had come to emerge. William O'Brien didn't know this. He thought Connolly was born in Cavan. In like Monaghan. He thought that as well. So Greaves proves this. Greaves has since like 1949, he had shown that Connolly was born in like Edinburgh, so he had that kind of kudos of it. So he writes to William O'Brien saying that, I've been talking to some people who knew Connolly back in the day. And they're saying that he was in the army, but he used a false name, and they think it was Reed, right?
Ooh.
So he did all of this. What we know now is that James Connolly's brother, John Connolly, was in the British Army, and he used a false name, John Reed.
So
what's happened is that in the 50 years, they've gotten the two brothers mixed up. Like, no one's going to know, yeah, there's the older brother. They're both in the same
color. Do you remember Jay Connolly?
Jay Connolly, there's James and John. So that causes confusion there anyway. And like, even in the like Donald Nevin book of like James Connolly's writings, they've got at least one article that was written by John Connolly, but they think it's James because it's Jay Connolly. But it was written by John because John, he was secretary. So the people make kind of mistakes there all the time. We're talking about people in 1956 being asked about something that happened in 1882. So we're talking about something from 1886 maybe. So we're talking about what? That's 60, 70 years later?
Yeah.
Right, so.
82, would have you been?
Yeah.
It was 1882. 70. You would have joined the army if it was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Greaves at 14, yeah.
Yeah. So they've gotten, if they're saying like, oh yeah, Jimmy, he was in the army, but he used the name Reed. It's called, no, you've gotten John mixed up with James, right? So that's one of his sources now, which you could probably say that is dubious. The second source is the most interesting one, and that's John Mulray. Now, John Mulray was born in Liverpool in 1879. That's still what's going on. His father was Irish and a tailor. They moved back into Ireland soon after he was born, and his brother Richard, he was born at 7 Great Longford Street in Dublin. This is all John kind of Mulray. They lived on the Clarendon Street where his sister Catchin was born. I found all this out just from doing kind of research.
Yeah.
And then in 1894, they crossed the Liffey and lived at 47 Marlborough Street. It's now become knocked down, where the Lewis stop is.
Yeah.
At the time of the 1901 census, they were living in a one-room containment building, and he was a qualified tailor. Now, how he met Connolly was that in 1996, the ISRP had their office at 60 on the first floor of 67 Middle Abbey Street. The shop at that time was a tailor's shop, and John Mulray worked in it. He would see Connolly going in and out. So he joins the ISRP in December 1897. I found the minutes. He joins on the 30th of December 1897. In the minutes they have,
I love it.
John Mulray has now joined.
Yeah.
But Greaves calls him Mullery in the book, right? All the way through. What happened? He meets John Mulray in 1957. Meets him in like Liverpool. And John Mulray tells him his story about kind of James Connolly. So all this, like, and the stories about him meeting his wife at the tram, about him being based in Cork. All of this comes from John Mulray.
Met his wife. I read a biography. I might be wrong now because it's a couple of years, a good few years, since I read a biography of Connolly. I read a couple of them. I thought he met Lily in Tipperary, where he was stationed. Or maybe, no, he was on release for the day from his station in Tipperary,
see,
is what they said.
Yeah, like, I am more than convinced that someone kind of wrote that down. There's no evidence for any of this stuff, right? Okay. So what you have here is that John Mulray knew, Connolly and Mulray fall out in 1902-1903. Connolly is kicked out of the ISRP. In like 1903, he's voted out, and Mulray is one of the people who voted him out.
Why?
Because Connolly came back from the States and found out that money he'd been sending back from his lecture tour, they'd been spending on a bar tab. They had opened a bar in their new offices on 138 Lower or Upper Abbey Street, and he basically just, they were drinking just the money he had raised on his lecture tour in the States. Ooh. So he went quick, because that was for a printing press, and he went fucking mental and said, I'm fucking leaving this here now. And there was a vote called, and it was passed, and then they kind of backtracked, but Connolly said, fuck is all. And then he left, and then he left for the States. However, Mulray then leaves for the States after Connolly. They meet in New York and become friends. And they write to each other. Connolly, he stuck for money, Mulray kind of helps him out. And they form in 1906, in 1907, they're both kind of founding members of the Irish Socialist Confederation. So it does, so he seems to have been a kind of family, a confidant. It does stand to reason that Connolly probably did tell him things, right? Mm. So like, it's not outside of the realms of the possibility. However, going back to, when he comes back to Ireland, Mulray, for some reason he changes his name, and he changes his name to John Mullery. And in the 1911 census, he's down as John Mullery. Sometime between like 1911 and 1925, he moves back to Liverpool, marries in 1925, and then dies in like 1958, and is buried as John Mullery, even though his birth cert, which I got, is like John Mulray. So he's born kind of John Mulray. The reason why I've gone into this whole kind of rigmarole about kind of this guy, because this guy is the one source that Greaves has for all the stories about kind of about that. What he doesn't mention is anything about Connolly deserting. Doesn't mention anything about Connolly being in Dundee hiding out, which is what kind of Greaves says in the book. Greaves makes all this up. Even the story that John Mulray tells Greaves about meeting kind of Lily, about missing a tram, Greaves writes it differently in the book. He says that Connolly walked from Beggars Bush Barracks, where he was based, walks into town, and then misses a tram. Now, even the story, it doesn't make sense, because he would have walked by all the stops. He was going out to Dunleary or out to Black Rock. The line passes by kind of Beggars Bush. So in the Greaves story, he walked by all these stops, gets to kind of Merrion Square, and then goes, oh, the tram, and then misses it. Right, no. The reason why Greaves says, that he puts in that bit about him walking down, is that he wants to reinforce that Connolly was in the army and has no evidence for it. So he's inventing evidence.
Yeah.
He has anecdotes, he has hearsay, but he has no evidence. Now, Greaves' diary stop in 1957, and there's a 3-year gap where he didn't write anything. Right, so in between 1957 and the book being published, we have no details then afterwards. But we do know is that Mulray dies soon afterwards. He's in an accident in like 1957. His son writes to William O'Brien in 1958 to inform O'Brien that Mulray, now Mullery, had died. O'Brien thought his name was Mulray, and then changes all the letters he writes in afterwards, Mullery. In all the letters that he had typed up, all of kind of Connolly's letters, because they went, oh, his name, it must have been Mullery then. They didn't know that he had actually changed his name in 1911.
They just thought they'd been spelling it wrong all those years.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And at the time when he's writing kind of this book, Connolly has, Greaves has no access to any of the Connolly archive. O'Brien says that I'm not giving that fucking communist anything, right? He says that he actually writes this to someone else.
Right.
He also says something. Am I kind of ranting on now?
No, not at all. I'm loving it.
Right. So, in 1983, though, this is where it gets kind of interesting about kind of maybe kind of Greaves got something wrong. That's okay. People get things wrong.
Yeah.
Right? But in 1983, John Neusinger, he was a member, he was an academic and a member of the SWM, as it was then, now the SWP, writes an article on James Connolly and 1916. And in it, he says kind of two things which are wrong. But he says in it that Jacqueline Mulray wrote to James Connolly when he was in the States. A year later, Greaves writes an article as a retort to that and says in it, there is no man named Mulray associated with Connolly. His name was Mullery. He lived not 4 miles from where I am writing, and I was often in his house. What's going on here is that Greaves was a chemist from Birkenhead.
Right.
He joins the Communist Party in 1936 and then joins the Connolly Association in the 1940s, ends up as editor of the newspaper in 1951. Now Birkenhead is just across the
Liverpool, yeah.
The Mersey. Mm. He never knew of him until Ina Connolly gave Greaves Mulray's home address in 1957. He's saying that about, I knew this man. I lived not 4 miles from him. Because he's trying to, this is just hard neck stuff.
Yeah.
He's basically trying to bamboozle everyone out there saying that I've got all this information. You don't have it. I have something special here. And he's winging it. He is fucking winging it, he is.
Why?
Because this gets into, first of all, he knows that he was on kind of, he knew that he didn't have any evidence for all the stuff that he was talking about. In the book itself, he says, those who reject his tale must tell us what else he was doing. So he actually says in it.
Jeez, so he knew he was lying and he was challenging people to call me out.
But he knew that he was on, if not kind of lying, he knew that he didn't have enough evidence for the statements he was making. If you make an argument, the onus is on you to provide the evidence for that. If you're on a TV debate and you say to the other guy, well, it's up to you now to show me evidence, to show me where I'm right.
Yeah.
So all the other stuff, he's hiding out in Dundee. It's ridiculous. It's all a figment of Greaves's.
These are known to include 1896 to 1903 and 1911. It's been shown that the missing 7 years cannot be placed between 1870 and 1880, so they must fall between 1882 and 1889. If Connolly was in Ireland then, as he must have been on his own statement, what was he doing? There is no alternative to set against the fact that the 1st Battalion of the King's Liverpool Regiment was in Ireland from precisely July 1882 to February 1889. Those who reject this must tell us what else he was doing.
So why, this is where kind of Greaves kind of has a problem, because Connolly, he's in the census in 1881 as a baker's kind of apprentice, right? And then he next shows up in a letter that has survived that he wrote there to Lily in April 1889. It's dated 1888, but it's been crossed off as kind of 1889. And Greaves, Connolly mentions a murder that happened on the street that he's living in. Greaves found that murder, and it was in April 1889. So it's definitely 1889.
Right.
So what he did was that he's a chemist, right? So he thinks it's factual. He has a 7 year gap. Connolly must only have been doing one thing during the whole time. So what was the regiment that was there for it? Ipso facto, he must be in that. And then it's up to you to kind of prove me wrong. What he can't explain is that Greaves has Connolly deserting the army when he has 4 months left on his 7-year term. Why would you do that, right? Yeah. So then he invents this entire other story that the reason why he did that was that his father was sick and he needed to go back and help him. If that's the case, why did he move to Dundee? Because his father lived in fucking in Edinburgh. Also, his father was still working. He wasn't ill enough that he wasn't working. In the 1891 census, he's
still working.
He's like still working. His wife dies in 1892. That's Connolly's
mother.
And Connolly, he's the witness because again that very distinctive handwriting. It's him. And then he's a witness for his father's death in like 1900 as well. So John's not around. Thomas, it seems, died. That was the other brother. And then his sister, who was born kind of before him, Margaret or Mary, it lived only 10 months, and she died in like 1866.
Right.
So Greece is like making up shit, but like again.
And having the audacity to say, if I'm wrong on this, you prove me wrong.
Yeah.
But like.
Having said all of that, like. It's still believable that Mulray knew Connolly well enough, that they knew each other well enough, because their letters are actually quite different to the other letters that have survived. Almost every other letter from Connolly that has survived is all business. It's all about how do you raise class consciousness. Yeah. It's all about the like struggle. Apart from his letters to Lily, and then his letters to Jack or John Con Mulray. Mm. They're friendly. They're different. So like he could have told him stuff. But the thing being is that it's the fact that Greaves felt that he had to say that he had to brazen it out. Means that is how he approached James Connolly. And that shows up in other parts of it then as well.
But see this Mulray stuff that he told Greaves. Did Mulray ever write down anywhere?
Nothing.
So this is all coming from Greaves, who's saying Mulray told him, but Mulray never wrote or documented anything.
No. And William O'Brien, who was quite kind of meticulous in his notes, he interviewed John Mulray in 1951. And John Mulray told him in 1951, I never knew Connolly was born in Edinburgh. In 1957, when he's talking to Greaves, he says, of course, you know that Connolly, he was born in like Edinburgh, like all that stuff back on the Monaghan, that's all horseshit. This happens a lot in anything to do with kind of oral history. If you're talking about kind of yourself, it's a different thing to when you're talking about your association to someone who's an historical figure. Yeah. You will garnish it. You will make out that you are closer maybe.
Yeah.
And then, I knew that. Oh, of course I knew him.
And with memory over time, 40, 50 years after Connolly's...
He was 78 when he's telling Greaves this stuff. Trying to remember stuff from nearly 60 years ago.
Yeah, which was hearsay at the time, because it wasn't like Connolly gave him a document and said, by the way, here's my history. So he's remembering a conversation from 60 years ago, repeating it to Greaves, who then decides to write it down.
And this gets into the other army story, which is that Connolly was based in Cork, right? And that comes from Mulray as well. And Mulray tells Greaves that Connolly told him about the time when it was a story of Mike Joyce. And Mike Joyce was a native Irish speaker. He didn't speak any English. He was accused of murder, was tried in English, couldn't understand what was going on. There was no translator. He was found guilty and hanged. It was a famous case in the 1880s. And Mulray says that Connolly told him that he was on guard that night and he felt kind of really bad for him. And he said that he was on guard in Cork, in Cork somewhere. But the problem being though was that Mike Joyce was hung in Galway. Now the way that the story is told, it sounds like Connolly was outside
listening to the cries.
The cell, right?
Yeah.
So it's what does Greaves do? Greaves says that the King's County Liverpool, they weren't on Spike Island during this time, but they were in Cork, so he must have been kind of he got his Cork story wrong. What What Greaves didn't do was check out, well, where was Joyce hung? Because he wasn't hung in fucking Cork, like. So he's not. It's unclear from it. Maybe he was saying that Connolly was just on guard that night, thinking about this story.
Yeah.
But the impression, but the gist of the story is that he was actually guarding him, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So already it's now kind of problematic, because even Greaves says in his book that Mullery, as he calls him, which is kind of right because he was Mullery at that time,
yeah.
Got his story wrong. Okay, that's fair enough. But now having proven that he can get stuff wrong, why are you assuming this part is right and that part isn't? This is confirmation bias. Happens in conspiracy theorists all the time.
Yeah.
You go online, you will have people who will pick and choose kind of facts because they're trying to find stuff that they've already reached a conclusion to.
Yeah.
It's confirmation bias.
Yeah.
What we have here is classic confirmation bias on the part of Greaves. He wants to prove that Connolly was in the army, so he takes the parts of like Mulray's story that he likes and rejects all the others and still makes kind of the argument anyway.
So what year was that one? The death, the 18...
It was the 1880s. I must kind of get it now.
So, is there...
No, just to be clear, remember, I'm not saying, could show up in 2 years' time, it could show up that there's a John Reed with James Connolly's handwriting, which, given his handwriting, it is very...
You'd imagine he'd stick to the same first name, though.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The brother was John Reed,
and his name was
John Connolly, yeah. Then James would go with James Reed.
James Reed,
so
yeah.
You'd expect it to show up as a James Reed, just in case someone called you...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
James.
Jimmy or so. Yeah, yeah. So, but it could still kind of show up. But the point being is that this is something that we go into, that I'm going to go into from now until the book is published in September, saying that this is a way of approaching Connolly that is problematic.
Yeah.
What I'm finding now is that Greaves is the other one who said that John Leslie, who was a Scottish socialist. He influenced James Connolly, he said, and he's the one that made James Connolly a nationalist, a Republican socialist. I think what's happened is that John Leslie, it was influenced by James Connolly.
Yeah.
I don't think James Connolly, it was influenced by John Leslie, because I'm finding that they're having meetings from 1890, 1891 onwards. We have letters from James Connolly writing to Keir Hardie, who's head of the
Labour Party,
giving him advice on how to run his fucking party. That's right. This is what we're talking about, right? He's 24.
Yeah.
He's writing to kind of Keir Hardie and saying, what you need to understand about X, Y, and Z. The other story is that I think when Connolly came over in 1895, 1896, it's still kind of unclear. In the Greaves, it's saying that he came over on the invitation of the Dublin Socialist Club, who paid him £1 a week to become a full-time kind of activist.
Right.
Again, no evidence. This is all hearsay. I think whoever told that story got their facts wrong. What happened is that in 1898, when the Gopher newspaper, Connolly says that I'll be full-time editor and try and raise me £1 a week. What happened is that whoever told him that story got the 1898 editor job mixed up with 1896. Because what happens in 1896 is that Connolly is given contacts for jobs in Dublin. And one of the jobs is Adolphus Shield. He was the father of Barry Fitzgerald, the actor.
Right.
Yeah. And he got him a job as a copy editor. And we know this because John Leslie says this in a letter he wrote to Edwin O'Brien in 1916. And also, the first child that's born in Dublin, I don't know who it is, it's Ina, I think, who's born in Dublin in 1896. On her birth cert, Connolly's job, proofreader. And this is in October 1896 or so. October, November 1896. So what happened is that Connolly is, I think, what happened now is that Connolly is being brought over to reinvigorate a branch of the Independent Labour Party in Ireland.
Right. He's highly critical at the time of the Labour Party and the drinking culture that was in it as well.
Well, that was in 1890, but that's later on.
Yeah, 1898, I think.
So and like he becomes fairly critical of Keir Hardie in 1891 or so onwards. Keir Hardie gave £50 towards the kind of setting up of Workers' Republic. That's 1898. They are fairly close, I think.
Yeah.
And like some of the letters that have survived have kindly laid out a strategy for building up socialism in Ireland. He writes this in 1894, 1895. And then he's over talking to members of the Independent Labour Party branch in Dublin, who were meeting until at least February 1896. They would still have kind of public meetings. And members of that are there at the first meeting of the RSRP.
And can I ask, so Connolly was put in charge of the GPO militarily for 1916.
Yeah.
A large part of that, I would have guessed, was the hypothesis that he was in the British Army.
No, see, again, like, I mean, like none of them were, like, if that was the case, then you make John McBride head of it.
Yeah, that's
what I mean. No, he was there because that was the payoff, because Connolly says that I'm doing this anyway, lads.
Yeah, just want to join.
And also, I've got my own guns and my own army, so we'll do this anyway.
Yeah.
So there's a different kind of dynamic that is.
But Pierce is in there with him, and he's in charge of.
Oh, I don't know. I have to go back to my notes.
But the point I'm making is, would Connolly have said I was in the army so that he could get the lead in militarily in there?
But once you go into that realm.
Yeah, it's speculation. Oh, but
you
I'm
could
just
say
wondering.
That it was fucking aliens kind of landed, if you're gonna go nuts, let's sort of get into it. There's one story that's told. William O'Brien told the ambassador. I think it was the Prime Minister of India. He told the ambassador to Ireland. He gave him an article Connolly had written on India,
right,
in like 1896, 1897, right? And then said, I have it from one of the Ling brothers who were in the ISRP that Connolly served in India, right? So then he told us, and then this ends up being told to the Prime Minister in Nehru of like India. From William O'Brien, who was on the bar, who at the time was a board member of the Irish Central Bank. Right? So that was the role that he was in then at the time. Where that came from, in that letter where Ling says he served in India, Ling also, he's in New York at the time, also says that stuff had Connolly been born like Edinburgh. That's all horseshit. He was adopted by that family, but he was born in Monaghan and then adopted and like sent over. Like, it's this crazy shit that has been made up forever. The thing here is that if your story is not linked to evidence, go nuts. You can say anything. You can say that it was there was people from Mars beamed down with a big halo and said, you're going to be head of the army. You're going to come out. You can say anything then. It's got to be linked to
evidence.
If it's not linked to evidence, it's all everything after that is all the same.
Yeah. It's fascinating about the logic of, because it's pure speculation, and he's just emphasizing more and more speculation, and I just can't figure out the motive of it other than look at me, I'm great, I know this, and I'm going to reproduce these things. And if I'm wrong,
but he says in his diary that there's a lot of people in Ireland who don't like the fact that Connolly it was in the army. So there was a bit of they just like trying to just like piss people off. Like, you know, he says this in his things. Having said all of that, it could still kind of show up, right?
Yeah.
But the point being is that from a research kind of point of view, you don't do this.
Yeah.
And then this ties into the other stuff. Again, going back to the Keir Hardie stuff. No, sorry, to the John Leslie stuff. John Leslie publishes first before Conor Connolly. So then, in his mind, Connolly must have got it from like John Leslie. He's going, no, they were part of a study group, of a Irish Socialist Republican study group who are meeting weekly in Scotland. And this is part of that. Because even what kind of John Leslie says doesn't go as far as what Connolly says 18 months later.
Yeah.
Right? So Connolly, there it is. As there's a story told from like Wittgenstein, where he was the philosopher who lived in Ireland in the 1940s. And he's in a class and they're arguing about just the sun going around the earth, and one of the students says, hey, we can't trust our eyes. We cannot simply trust our eyes, right? If you look up at the sky, it looks like the sun goes around the earth. And Wittgenstein said, really, says, and what would the sun look like if the earth, it went around the sun?
Yeah, yeah.
So what we have in terms of Greaves is that he's saying that Connolly, it was influenced by John Leslie. And I'm there going, why? What would it look like if John Leslie, it was influenced by James Connolly? Yeah. Exactly the deal I'm fucking saying. The reason why I'd say that the evidence falls on Connolly is that the only political thing John Leslie ever fucking wrote was these kind of three articles. And after that, it's just poems.
Right.
There's nothing else. There's nothing before it, and there's nothing after it.
So where is he?
So he's doing all of this. John Leslie writes these three articles, which are very kind of Connolly-esque.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing. Absolutely nothing afterwards.
And what year did it stop?
1895.
Right? Okay, the article stopped.
1894, right?
Okay.
So you have nothing in the lead up, a James Connolly type kind of analysis, and nothing afterwards.
Tell me, why does it seem more natural for people to believe that the sun goes around the earth rather than the other way around?
Well, obviously, because it looks that way.
I see. And how would it look if the earth went around the sun?
Well, I suppose
it's interesting. I think the 7-year gap that Greaves is talking about, there is absolutely no documentation one way or another of where he was or what was going on.
No, there's nothing. It's the evidence of that.
As I said earlier on, like if you're in the British Army has its records going back centuries before
exactly.
that.
You know, and even he had. He had asked the kind of British Army to go through kind of records. He had paid for it, and he did the service. And they had said to him that the British Army told him it's most likely that he was in the King's County Liverpool. So we checked there first. So his diary ends when they're checking it, and they can't find anything.
And if they did, he probably wouldn't say it anyway.
Greaves also says that his brother, John, served in the King's in Liverpool, but we have his record, and he wasn't. He was in the Border Regiment and the Royal Scots.
The Border Regiment?
Mm. And the Royal Scots. Because he joins back, he joins back in the army in at the start of the World War. And that's right. And that's what kills him. He's sent kind of mining German prisoners of war, and he gets an infection. He's in his 50s, and the place kind of kills him off. He dies actually in August, May or June, July or August, 1916. About 2 months after his brother.
Wow, Jesus, fascinating stuff. I just can't get my head around why Greaves would fill in the blanks with speculation.
Like, if you go online, like, what are tech bros like? Have you ever had an argument, with a tech bro? They're a pain in the fucking hole because they see everything, in fucking binary terms.
Yeah.
Greaves is a 1950s tech bro. he was wanted into the history and said, I'm going to sort this out now.
Yeah.
And also, he has a very dogmatic kind of Marxism. He does not understand, he doesn't really understand the innovation that Connolly says. He actually says in it, Connolly was not an original thinker. When Connolly preempted anti-imperialist, anti-colonial, Republican and Marxism that sweeps the world from the 1930s onwards,
quoted by Lenin,
in terms of but also like in terms of what he brought to the table, which is the type of Marxism that emerges out of Asia, out of Africa, and out of South America as well. Connolly is in a tradition where he is not is in British Marxism, which is imperialist Marxism.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like,
so he doesn't fucking understand it anyway.
Anyone that reads any of Connolly's main works is going to see the original thinking that's going on there in his head. Like, I remember having a chat with yourself and Donald Fallon about some of the stuff that he wrote as well, where Connolly was wrong on his historical research, bits and pieces here and there, but I suppose he probably wasn't dealing with the same sort of level of detail that we have now.
But like, even in that, I mean, like, Connolly is not using the Brehon laws to prove that Ireland can be communist. His Marxism is not based on whether the Brehon laws were communism or not. That's not the basis of his Marxism. He's using that as kind of propaganda, because again, goes back to Connolly. He's a street agitator.
Yeah,
that's what he's doing. So he's using arguments that will help win people over in terms of things.
Yeah.
He wasn't that far out either, because, like, again, he gets kind of misquoted, because in Labour, in Irish history, he says that we cannot go back to the Brehon laws. It is organically impossible. And that line gets left out, where he says himself, no, I'm not talking about this.
Yeah. And he gets quoted as that's what he was looking for.
Exactly. Even though he says in the book itself, this is not what I'm looking for here. I'm using this purely as an example to highlight what we now call the kind of colonial history of capitalism in Ireland, because it came from Britain. It came there with the invasion. He says in Labour, in Irish history, we would have developed a capitalism anyway.
Yeah.
But the type that we got, it's an imperialist one. It's a colonial one. He doesn't use those words, but that's what he's put forward.
Yeah.
And that's the innovation. It goes over
capitalism.
It goes over Greaves' head completely.
And just on that, because then you have like Daniel O'Connell and his hatred for Daniel O'Connell. I was only thinking about this before we started recording. Was he's only one generation away from O'Connell, and like his obvious hatred for O'Connell. And you mentioned like where nobody knows where Connolly got the information from. Like the research on O'Connell, I went looking for the information that he got to see if I could find it in the debates in Parliament in Westminster. Couldn't find anything.
Mm-hmm. No, like see, that's what I'm doing now. Is that I'm going back to where Connolly found this stuff.
Brilliant.
So I haven't gotten to Labour in Irish history yet, because I mean that's 1898 later part.
Yeah.
I stop before Works Public comes out, which is August 1898. So I'm covering 1891 up until 1898. It's 80,000 words.
So 91 is when the first article or communication from Connolly came. And in your writings, or in the book, is it going to be like his writings, his letters as well?
Yeah,
everything. Brilliant.
So it's everything. It's everything that we have at the moment. Everything I've found, everything that we knew about but hasn't been republished, and then stuff that we knew about and has been republished.
Right. Okay.
So there are three elements to that, and that's mainly the letters to kind of Keir Hardie and to his wife, and then some of the articles which became Aaron's Hope.
Right.
Ireland for the Irish. That was the title that he gave us. So it's on the far right. We'll fucking love that, like, you know.
Yeah, I only bought that recently. Yeah. Must have a read. Yeah.
But that's the first part of it.
Yeah.
So basically, from now until September, we might take one or two more, where it's going to kind of these things, these elements of each kind of biog that are just, that have sent us on the wrong track.